This morning, we are delighted to have the next instalment in our radio book club and the author Edward Hamlin joining us live in the studio. But first, I'd like to welcome my co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
It's great to have you. And another great selection, Arsene, I have to say. You knock it out of the park every month with the books that you pick. And this one, a favourite of mine for a couple of reasons, one of which we'll explore in a minute. One of them being it's short stories. And this is just a thing that I love to read.
Yeah, I love short stories too, which is what makes us such a great team. We both love these stories. And these stories are really a great example of what the form can do. You know, the compression in the stories, the crisis, the conflicts come quickly, the development of characters almost instantly. You feel like there's really not a wasted word. I mean, you get right to the story, but at the same time, they're not melodramatic. And I think this is a fine example of what great short stories can be.
Well, our guest this morning is Edward Hamlin, and his latest book is Night in Urkcheby and Other Stories. It's great to have you in the studio.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to ask you about the title story first, which is really an amazing story, which I think captures a lot of the themes that run through the book. It's Night in Urkcheby, and it's about a marriage, and they're on a vacation in Morocco, and you find out that they're trying to overcome the woman's grief of her brother who's died in the war, and he's died 7 months ago to the day from the story starts, and things kind of spin out of control from there. And I thought maybe you could talk about what the inspiration for this was, and maybe, you know, some of your thoughts about what you're trying to touch upon in this story.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the direct inspiration was following the news and my own, I suppose, emotional and intellectual reactions to the war, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and really thinking about what's the impact, almost the PTSD, though I don't want to sort of make it clinical sounding, but what's the impact on the families, not just the soldiers? And I think I'm interested in that because I keep writing stories about it. The most recent story that I published in the Colorado Review after Dreamland is also about the aftermath of war. So I think, you know, in that regard, the germ of the story was in the wars, and then just an empathetic imagining of what happens to families when they lose someone in the war.
Yeah, so they go on this vacation to Morocco, but it's not solace for them. Nothing's really going right on this vacation. It's a hard vacation, which is kind of interesting to me. I'd recently read an old Updike story called Morocco, where that's a family vacation where everything goes wrong on vacation in Morocco. But in this story, she not only do things go wrong, she has to confront her deepest fears when she gets out in that desert, doesn't she?
That's right. She doesn't see it coming either.
Yeah, and so I guess she's almost imagining what her brother had to go through in that situation and being in a war in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's plunged into the ambiance of the Middle East. She's in the desert. She's just being a tourist, although it's really her husband's idea to take the trip, hoping that it will get her out of her grief. And but then suddenly she's in a setting that just physically is similar to what she imagined her brother to be in. And that it's really the atmosphere of the place that triggers some of these difficult emotions for her.
Yeah, and so they're alone in this tent in the middle of the desert, really, and she runs off, mm-hmm. and kind of has this very intense moment, the time where she, you know, where she's having this conversation with a guard who doesn't understand what she says. Mm-hmm. I thought that was interesting. She's able to talk to somebody who can't understand her.
Yeah, I mean, it's an old technique in fiction to have sort of the mirror character whose job is to essentially mirror your point of view character. And he understands that she's in crisis because he can read her emotionally. She's not hiding it very well. But he doesn't really know the details because he doesn't understand English and she can't speak his language. And so they have to find a way to communicate. And she does some things that are culturally difficult for him. She strips naked in the desert. He turns away, doesn't look at her. In the meantime, she, you know, takes the opportunity to do some other things that I think heighten the threat level in the story for the reader.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could read us. You know, I always like to have our authors read on the air just so you get a feeling of the voice and the language of the book. And I think this is particularly beautiful. I'm actually going to have you do something we've never really done before, have you read the end of the story. Mm-hmm. it still will be worth reading if you haven't read it yet, even if you do know the end.
It's not the only spoiler.
Yeah, no, it's beautiful. But if you could maybe start here and maybe set up exactly what, you know, the moment leading up to that.
Okay. Well, at this point, the couple have been in the desert. They're on one of these sort of tourist excursions, overnight excursions to go into the desert in Morocco, the Sahara, sleep in a Bedouin tent, eat a native meal, do all this kind of stuff. And the company running it is a little bit schlocky. You know, it's not an elegant experience. But in the middle of it all, she's having an emotional breakdown. And so by the time we reach this point in the story, she's out in the dunes. She's commandeered the automatic weapon of this guard. She's perhaps about to kill herself. Her husband isn't sure. And so we're at a moment of maximum tension, really. And I'll just read from there. From atop the adjacent dune, a snort and a spit announce the presence of a camel. The rider sweeps the odd scene with a powerful handheld spotlight, lingering on the American woman's ghostly white skin, the arc of her body, her splayed leg. Behind the blinding beam, Wilson can just make out the sheik on his mount and the zouave standing beside the huge animal. The two men exchange words in Arabic, and the sheik laughs mirthlessly, sitting back in his rug saddle and toying with the reins. His camel stamps the sand and tosses its head in irritation, eager to get back to camp, its pruney smell rolling down the slope of the dune. Then the spotlight snaps off again and the desert closes in suddenly. The zouave moves effortlessly through the complete darkness and retrieves the discarded rifle, the sound of its swinging strap the only indication that he has taken it. With a dismissive snort, the camel lumbers down the far side of the dune, the zouave presumably following, and Anna and Wilson are alone in the desert, shipwrecked in an invisible sea. Wilson feels his way across the dune toward Anna and comes upon her soft thigh, a thing of great delicacy next to the gritty sand. He lies down beside his wife and embraces her in the impenetrable Moroccan night, the two of them shivering in the cold, her nails digging into his back. When they get to their feet, sometime later, the sky has cleared and the firmament above is exploding with stars, a celestial firestorm as suffocating as it is beautiful. Though they are freezing, though the hulking dunes visible again in the starlight are terrifying in their mass, they stop and look upward, unable to ignore the spectacle above. "Take me home, Wilson," Anna says quietly. "I think all these stars might kill me."
That's author Edward Hamlin reading from his short story, Night in Erg Chebbi. That's a part of a collection of a book of short stories in a book by the same name, Night in Erg Chebbi and Other Stories. And it has been our selection this month in our Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore joining us, as always, in the studio. And Edward, Erg Chebbi, it's a real place. It's in the southern part of Morocco. Have you been there? I mean, have you gone to all these places?
I haven't. This is the one exotic locale in all those stories that I have not been to. My wife and I were actually planning a trip to the Middle East. We've been kind of wanting to go to Morocco for probably a decade. And so, you know, we're getting closer to that moment. And then the Arab Spring happened. And we decided not to do that at that moment. So, no, a lot of the story is based on research and some friends who've spent a lot of time in Morocco.
So, I mean, that was going to be one of my questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, what are the challenges of writing about a place when the place is such an integral part of the story when you actually haven't been there?
Yeah, it's challenging, but I love doing research, so it's fun.
Well, that sense of place is a real theme through the book. It really does bring us to exotic locations. And the first story in the collection, we're in the jungle in Brazil, but other exotic, some not quite so exotic locations are mentioned as part of that story. And when I started reading it, I was surprised to find the protagonist is called Maeve.
Indeed. That's for you.
Thank you, Edward. Well, I appreciate that. But she's originally from Ireland, from Belfast, and she has had rather a circuitous route to this Brazilian jungle.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, yeah. She's a transplant from Belfast at the height of the Troubles in 1972 to Haiti. And I won't spoil the story of how she winds up in Haiti, but she's in Haiti and finds herself there under Baby Doc, which is an equally dangerous situation, but with less familiar elements to it for her. She kind of understands what's going on in Belfast. She doesn't understand anything about what's going on in Haiti. And then later in her life, she works her way toward the Amazon in Brazil and winds up running a guest house there. And that's sort of where we pick her up, encounters an exotic, strange, reclusive American who I think this, I guess I can give this away. The seed of that character was John McAfee, the software entrepreneur who, you know, secreted himself in Central America and was finally located through a technology slip. He sent photographs to the people that were looking for him because he was accused of murder. And in the photographs were his exact geographic location, you know, his geographic coordinates. And so they were able to find him. But he was, I wanted to write a story about him. And that was one thread that fed into this.
Well, as you mentioned, she's from Belfast, the height of the Troubles, ended up in Haiti, now in Brazil. Any point in her, you know, story would be really interesting. Why did you pick this particular point in her story? And when you're writing a short story and you have such complex characters, how do you hone in on this one particular, you know, moment? It's, you know, longer than a moment, but this particular point in their lives.
Yeah. Well, I think I was interested in her as a mature woman. I wanted to understand how she had processed this very complicated, strange patchwork of a past. And both phases of her past that are covered in the story, both the Belfast phase and the Haiti phase, had their own traumas for her. It's very, very difficult for her. But I was very interested in her as a 37, 38-year-old woman who's a very strong woman, has established a completely different life for herself, but hasn't quite emancipated herself from those conflicts.
It seems like you tend to drop into the short stories as almost as late as possible. You know, you've got a story where it's called Head Shy, where the girl is pregnant at this point. The young woman is pregnant and things are coming to a head right away. Mm-hmm. You have another story, Boy Unleashed, where social services are already there and the woman's in the car and the kid is, you know, being taken away as the story opens. Mm-hmm. And so tell me about this. Is this just your sense of how to do it? Or is there a reason you like to drop in so late or as late as possible?
I wish it were that conscious. I don't know. I mean, choosing the frame is a really, really important moment when you're starting to compose a story. And I don't know that I have a formula for that, but I think I do like the sort of retrospective pull. And there's a sort of spiraling structure you can use in stories and in novels where you start off like at the 11th hour of the story and then you retrospectively go back and you work your way up toward it. And then in the denouement, you go from 11th hour to 12th hour. And that's a structure I've used a lot too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I find it very effective and it really heightens the tension. You drop into the story, this moment of tension, this family, Boy Unleashed, for instance, families being torn apart. It's the only first person story too, which we can get to as well later, and things are already at a crisis. And then you work your way back because they're in such an absurd situation. They found the boy on a leash in the backyard, so of course social services are there with the police. But then you work your way back, and then by the time you get to the denouement, you kind of are there with the father, saying, "Well, he was doing the best he could," like, which is almost an unheard of idea when you first open the story.
Yeah, and I mean, I've worked for many years in my day job in the child welfare arena. And that story, it wasn't inspired by anything that came in through my work. It was inspired actually by a newspaper clipping about an actual little boy who was autistic in California and ran off. His parents had chained him up. And then he escaped from his school. And he ran off into the forest, and they had to then try to find him. And being autistic, he was frightened of loud noises. They couldn't use bullhorns to try to find him because he would just run the other way. So, you know, what I guess I was interested in that story is not judging morally, you know, because these family situations are horribly complex, and there are a lot of victims. And I wanted to write a story that didn't take sides, though I amped up the moral dilemma so much that it's hard for the reader not to take sides. So that was my discipline in that story, is can I write this ambiguous, complicated, messy, smelly, chunky situation without judging?
Well, you make it harder for the reader by going first person there, which you don't mm-hmm. do in any other story. And so we're forced to be with the father, in the father, for those pages. Is that why you went first person, to probably balance it? If I tell the story objectively, I'm not going to be able to get a balance on the moral judgment?
Maybe so. I mean, I wanted to be inside his moral universe, his head. Like, how does he reconcile his tying his child up, who is autistic and is prone to run away? And, you know, if you talk to families or you read about families who do this kind of stuff, from the outside, it looks just horrific. From the inside, they have a thought universe where it makes sense. I wanted to experiment with that.
That's author Edward Hamlin joining us in the KGNU studios this morning. He is the author of Night in Erg Chebi and Other Stories, and that has been this month's selection for our Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, and my co-host, as always, Arsen Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore, joining us in the studio. And there are so many stories, and a lot of the stories are written with female characters. And mm-hmm. I am always just interested, how does a man write a female character, and how do you do it well, which you do?
Yeah, I was going to ask if you think I succeeded or failed miserably in that. I've wondered this a lot. I mean, that's been pointed out a couple of times to me, and I never thought about it consciously. Until
by women?
By women, yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been blessed to have some really strong women in my life, you know, starting with my mother, who's a thriving senior citizen, you know, incredibly capable, but a lot of other women. And I think I'm intrigued by, I want to say, what women are up against, you know, in our culture, because obviously it's not like it was in 1950, but it's still tough. And to the extent a writer is interested in conflict and people working through conflict and taking ownership of their lives and situations that they find themselves in, I think I'm intrigued a little bit more by women trying to do that.
You've such a collection of characters in the stories that you've written about. We've touched on some of them, but I've met writers in the past who seem to collect characters when they're out and about. They have their notebook and they might meet someone interesting in the line waiting for coffee in the morning or sitting beside someone on a bus. I mean, is that something you do consciously, or do you do it at all?
Oh, I do. I mean, my ears are always peaked for dialogue and conversation, for one thing. And, I wrote a story I still really like. It's not in the book. Sitting at LaGuardia on a layover and just sort of taking notes. I mean, you know, in the menagerie, right? So sometimes it's very easy to do that. Other characters are more out of my imagination.
And is this you imagining, say, if you are sitting in LaGuardia, where these people are coming from? Or do you actually engage
exactly.
in a conversation and try and find out their actual story?
Sometimes I'll do that. Sometimes a story will emerge from a direct encounter. Yeah.
One thing I want, some of your characters are dead. There seems to be a very thin membrane between the living and the dead in a lot of these stories. There's a one child policy where a girl's, her 18th birthday, I believe, and she's in New York, a Chinese immigrant who's really struggling, and she's constantly thinking of her mother. There's another story, The Release, where a woman lived with her husband, and they kind of had this silent, they got along, the kids were out of the house, but they're very silent. And then you in the second page, you say things didn't really change much after he was dead. He was mm-hmm. silent, but he was in an urn. Mm-hmm. But she's still thinking of him. But there seems to be just this, people are very connected with people after they die and in different ways in your stories. And that, like I said, it seems like a thin membrane you've got going.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's one of the big themes, isn't it, right? I'm glad you mentioned one child story, because at the very final scene, we find this young Chinese woman who's been literally mugged on the New York subways and is really beat up and in trouble, going home to her freezing cold apartment, lying on the floor, imagining her late mother. And I've had people say, well, she was dead, right? She died, right? And other people are like, no, she didn't die. What are you talking about? And I suspend judgment. I myself am not sure whether she dies at the end of the story. I don't need to know that.
Mm-hmm. When whether she's alive, even if she dies at the end, that's one thing. But even if, even before, when she's obviously alive, she's very connected to the mother. Yes. In a way, she's not connected to really anybody else in that story.
That's right.
I thought that was very interesting. What I liked about the women characters, Maeve, a lot is you get a whole spectrum. It's not women as victims, or it's not women as strong, you know, career women who have succeeded. You get both. You get this amazing photographer in Light Years. You get the woman in Not Yet, who's kind of living on her own up above here, or the mountains above Boulder. And then, but then you do get this Chinese immigrant who's really a terrible victim of her gender, of her race, of her situation. And so I feel like you plumb the spectrum of what it is to be a woman in America to some extent, or a woman in the world. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was very interesting coming from a male writer.
Well, the last story I wrote, which is going to be published in Plowshares next year, is about a lesbian couple in Paris. So I'm stretching probably farther than I should, but at least one editor thought it worked.
There was one really interesting story to me, and I wondered, was this something plucked from real life? Because you did mention some real life inspiration. Clemency, the one about the death penalty, because it's a real mystery that actually unfolds over the course of the pages in this short story. Was this, this is set on the night of, there's supposed to be an execution, and there's a vigil and a rally at the governor's mansion waiting, you know, to whether he'll do the thumbs up or thumbs down, kind of in a Caesar way. But very suspenseful. Was this something that you had heard about in real life?
You know, that's the story in the book that probably was most created from whole cloth. There was no sort of news article event thing that stimulated that. I mean, I'm interested in the death penalty as a social issue. But of course, the story is not really about the death penalty. It's really about...
It's a whodunit.
It's a whodunit, and it's someone who is accused of murder, but actually didn't do the murder, the point of view character, but then winds up murdering someone after all. And that actually did not come from any specific event.
Well, that was a real page turner. I thought it was like, oh my God, the big reveal at the end.
Well, you always like to know what's going to be the movie. And I think certainly it's a pretty short story. So I don't know if you've got quite enough that to be fleshed out to really be a movie, but you certainly have the last 30 to 45 minutes of a movie in that story. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very visual. You really paint the rally and people in favor of the execution row, and you paint the vigil of people against it. And I thought it was just fantastic. I really liked that story, and it was a whodunit. Which is great. It's at the very end of the book, and you're reading, and it was fun to create that mystery element.
And that also has that moral complexity that you talked about, you know, in the original story or the first story, Night in Archebi, with the first story that we read from. You know, the conflict internally that you feel about the war. And yet this is the same. It kind of brings up internal conflict, maybe about the death penalty. It's not always as black and white as maybe we think it is or think it should be.
And that the woman that he encounters at the rally, the elderly woman who's really tough and savvy and strong, she becomes, in a way, my sort of moral foil for that discussion.
Well, we just have a couple of minutes left. And as we are running out of time, I did want to ask you about whether when you finish a story, whether you're really trying to rein yourself in and whether you feel I could write another 5 chapters. Heck, let's just write a novel. Is that an issue?
Well, you know, the first story in the book was a 5,000 word story, and then it became a 95,000 word novel. So I guess I didn't rein myself in too well. But knowing when to end the story is key. And I'm really striving for more compression. I tend to write long, and, you know, like that particular story is 5,000 words because I was entering it in a UK contest and that was the word limit. And that's very hard for me. 5,000 is very hard for me.
You like contests, right? You won the Iowa Short Fiction Award is how you got published, and with Karen Russell judged, I believe, right?
Yes.
But you've won another number of other reward. Is there something motivating about these contests for you, or, you know, how does that affect you as a writer a little bit?
Certainly can be. I mean, it gives you a deadline for one thing. I just wrote a story that was too long, 10,000 word story. I don't want to write stories that long often, but I wanted to enter it in the Missouri Review Jeffrey Smith Editor's Prize, which I was a finalist for last year with Indigena. And the limit was 8,500 words. So last weekend I sat down and I somehow cut 1,500 words out of that thing without killing it, I hope.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I, your stories are, I don't know how the word count, but the page count tends to be 10 to 20 pages, most of them, with not yet the one about the fire in the mountains above here, stretching maybe to 30 pages. But I thought you handled that 30-page story seemed very satisfying to me, and that was a little more, I don't want to say developed, because they're all developed, but you were able to meander a bit more in that mm-hmm. story than some of the other ones.
True.
And maybe that should be the story that we wrap up the interview with, because it is set right here in mm-hmm. Colorado, in the foothills, and there's a wildfire. There's a whole lot of other stuff going on, but I suppose the dramatic part of it is that there's a wildfire, mm-hmm. another influenced by real life.
Absolutely. We moved here from Chicago about 10 years ago, and I think we didn't know enough about the wildfire risk here, and we live in the foothills. So the stimulus for that story was the Four Mile Canyon fire. And, we literally had ash landing on our deck. I mean, it wasn't close enough to threaten our home, but we didn't know that, you know. So it was frightening and made a big impression on me. I didn't want to write a story so much about the fire as trying to imagine what if you were the one who had accidentally set it, which became the germ of that story.
Well, that was one of the terrific stories that are part of the collection Night in Urgchebby and Other Stories. Edward Hamlin is the author, and we were delighted to have him live in the KGNU studios for this month's edition of the Radio Book Club. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And Arsene Kashkashian, we always end the shows with announcing what the next read will be, what the next selection. And I would like to invite our listeners to read along with us as we enjoy Robert Olin Butler's Perfume River. Tell us about this.
Well, I'm very excited. Robert Olin Butler won the Pulitzer Prize in the early 90s for Scent from a Strange Mountain, which was a collection of short stories about Vietnamese refugees in Louisiana, I believe. And so this story, he returns to kind of the Vietnamese War he hasn't done much with the Vietnamese War since then. And this is a novel where he looks at an American family and how they're being torn apart by that war, and what's happening now 40 years later, how that war is still affecting the family and how they relate to each other. And I think he's a great writer. I think he's really one of the great writers of America right now. And I'm just really excited that we're going to get a chance to talk to him.
September 29th, you can hear Robert Olin Butler talk about his novel, Perfume River. We'll put more information at our website, news.kgnu.org. If you go there, you can find all of the archives of our Radio Book Club. We've had so many authors and such a great selection of books. And so do dip in, listen back to the interviews that we've done with the authors. And we're going to be launching this as a podcast with some after-hours content available too. So do stay tuned for that. But I'd like to thank Edward Hamlin for coming in, Arsene Kashkashian with the Boulder Bookstore. Thanks to our listeners for listening along with us this morning. This month's selection was Night in Urgchebby and Other Stories. Find out more at our website, kgnu.org.